You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KUSP, Santa Cruz, and streaming worldwide at KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or the Pataphysical Broadcasting Foundation, or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. Hey, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, an iOS developer, and a lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle. How you doing?
Pretty well. Quite well, thank you. And Mr. Miles Elam. It's been a little while, Miles. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Hi.
Hello.
Have you been politicizing or software engineering?
I have indeed.
What have you been working on lately in software?
I've been trying to round out my skills. I've been putting
your skills
off...
are amazing. What do you mean round them out?
Well, like you're going to get a carpenter or something? I've been putting off for many years learning PHP. I had some
of course you should. What?
I had some issues with learning the language. I was just didn't want to deal with it. When I say issues with learning the language, I tend to be a snob, a language snob. Yeah. And so I'm getting over that, just being like, you know what, just...
it's a very popular language.
Yes, exactly.
You and I worked on a PHP project at one point for a friend.
Yeah, I limped through one.
And you hated it, as I recall.
Yeah, but, and the thing is, there is something to be said for learn a language before you start tinkering with it, because you're doing a lot of stuff by trial and error, which is really useful when you're first learning and you're first going into programming.
But not right when you have a client waiting for you.
Exactly, and not when you're actually getting paid. When you're actually a professional, you should learn your how to use your tool before you're stuck with using
it. What is PHP?
What does it stand for anymore? Something hypertext processor, pretty hypertext processor, something like that. And it originally started off, people talk about it as much, but it really started off as an answer to Perl, because it used to be you wrote a Perl program and you embedded a whole bunch of HTML into this Perl program, especially when there wasn't that much logic, you were trying to shoehorn this in there. And so PHP kind of inverted that and made it so that you wrote basically an HTML document, and then you insert just that bit of code that you need. But then over time, PHP got bigger, and people started writing whole frameworks with it, and so it ended up being a whole bunch of logic and not much markup, which was the reason why they moved away from Perl in the first place, and it all becomes messy.
And there's a lot of joking with geeks about PHP, but in reality, it's a very popular language. If you've heard of WordPress or Drupal, those are both frameworks built on top of PHP.
So I still wouldn't call it an elegant language, but it's a very pragmatic language.
I'll grant it that. And I think it's neat that you're spending some time looking at that language. Cool.
And Python. I've actually taught Python before, but it was just in the context of enough to get a game going. So I didn't need to have a deep understanding of the language. And so going back to actually say, what are all the language constructs? Let me learn all the little nuts and bolts. What are all the design patterns being used there? It's enlightening to spend time to do that.
Our Canadian correspondent, Mr. Merkley, says that while PHP originally stood for personal homepage.
Thank you.
Serious?
I guess that's what
I
hear.
Yeah, yes. That's right.
It now stands for the recursive backronym, which is a great term, for PHP hypertext processor. So the P in PHP stands for PHP. It angers me. My spine tightens when I hear that. I guess they're called backronyms, which I like.
So you're talking about WordPress and asking if anybody has ever heard of it. Did you hear that WordPress is now running 25% of the sites on the internet?
Whoa, that's a lot of sites.
25% of the entire...
WordPress tends to have security problems, which means that 25% of websites become...
So you know, vectors. I used to have that problem with WordPress, but now the ISP that I use, or the hosting facility that I use, has automatic updates for my WordPress installs. So I get emails every once in a while saying, security patch, it's been patched, which is great. That's that's worth so much. I don't have to go do anything. I click on a link to make sure it's still up, but that's it. But that's a lot of websites.
That's a lot of websites.
Of course, there are a lot of websites.
But I mean, you're asking about PHP. How does anybody know about it? But if a quarter of the internet is being run on it, that's
really important stuff.
Pretty big thing.
Well, thanks for that stat. Hey, let's talk about North Carolina, shall we?
Oh, do we have to?
I just love this story. And this is more jokey than anything else. We're going to get more serious later, but let's talk about this.
Let's preface this with, it'll sound like it, but this is not The Onion.
This is not The Onion. All right.
Okay, so Woodland, North Carolina. And in general, I like North Carolina. North Carolina has their digital triangle. I've forgotten the exact word for it. I'm sorry for people who live in the area, but North Carolina has a great tech industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
They are ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, they haven't taken Woodland, North Carolina with them. Mm. Woodland, North Carolina recently at a town hall meeting talked about how they don't want solar panels in their town as a solar panel farm.
Why?
In the words of a retired science teacher in the town who lives in the town, sorry, I'm having trouble choking
Come on.
He expressed concern that that these solar panels would block photosynthesis and prevent nearby plants from growing.
Nearby, as in under the panels?
It would affect the plants under the panels.
Yes, but
like a house affects plants under it.
Right. How anything affects it. And
all right,
there also is a woman by the name of Jane Mann who spoke at the meeting saying that there seemed to be a lot of cancer deaths in the area and no one could tell her that solar panels didn't cause cancer.
What would be the... I mean, manufacturing solar panels probably is pretty bad, but the actual panels are pretty safe.
Well, they deal with radiation. Solar panels do work with radiation.
You guys are angering me so much.
Yeah, see, I am in favor of the precautionary principle in general.
Absolutely.
However, I am also in favor of looking at, if you're not getting your power from solar...
Yes, what are you going to use it?
You're getting it from...
Nuclear, coal, or natural gas, or gas. Wind.
Or wind, yeah.
I just listed all the ones that you could possibly get your power. Almost everybody's getting from natural gas.
Right. And you need something for base load, something that doesn't matter if the wind is blowing or the sun is shining. You need something there. And I'm pretty sure that coal plants cause cancer.
Yeah, they do.
Not just, you'd have to prove it to me, but I mean, like, it's already, I mean, we have the epidemiology dictating that, yes, this causes a problem. We know the dangers of that. Solar panels, there are issues with their construction, their manufacture. That could be cleaner. No question.
Absolutely.
A clean room and making semiconductors on a large scale has some issues. Compared to fossil fuels, they don't have any issues.
Right. So North Carolina's used one, what is it, above a trillion?
Terawatt?
A quadrillion.
1.5 quadrillion BTUs of fossil fuels in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And it's just...
Anyway, let's move on, shall we? Too depressing. Can you get another really fun quote? Well, I think the one causing cancer is pretty ridiculous.
No, those are the big ones. Yeah, the same woman saying, I want information. Enough is enough. There's plenty of information.
Sucking energy from the sun. I love that. The idea that would pull the energy from the sun and destroy the sun. Beautiful. All right.
Well, just that it sucks all the light from the surrounding area so the plants can't get it. Like, no, that people haven't heard the concept of a shadow.
So, guys, I don't want to go down a mire on this, but I do want to talk a little bit about some experience that I've been having for a while with my children and kind of paying attention to this. And this has to do with data mining and corporations in public infrastructures. And in general, when I worked at UCSC, I went through the migration process of us running our own mail servers, which were always kind of problematic, expensive to run at UCSC. And at one point, we made a deal with Google, and all of the accounts within a year transferred over so that Google was handling all the email infrastructure for all the staff. And it was really cool because email didn't go down anymore. And there were some side effect problems, but in general, it was great, except that we also... Then after the staffs all did it, we then had all the students do it. So you go to a public university and you get a Google account. Okay, fine. You're at a university. It's your choice to go there. And What's wrong with that? It's a great service. I use Google. You guys
use
Google?
Well, you're paying for Google as opposed to paying the salaries for the people who are maintaining the math, the mail servers.
That's right. So. There was this concern, of course, that ads would be marketed to the students and, you know, what's the trade-off and everything. But when it comes down to it, you know, ask a student if they want to raise their tuition or have an ad, and they'll probably say, have an ad. And so the university made the decision across the board that that's what's happening. This year, or maybe last year, all of the students at the elementary schools that my kids go to now have Gmail accounts, and they use Google Docs, which is the online software package by Google for word processing and Excel sheets and things like that. They present their classwork presentations using Google Slides, right? So it's a very embedded, and it's fantastic. I mean, as a parent, it's great because my kids now, I get to talk with them about, you know, what their homework is. And let's say they've been kind of procrastinating starting the paper. And I go, well, can I see it? I'm thinking I'm going to talk about this. And so I'll pull up my laptop, which of course I'm on all the time because I program, and I'll pull up a doc and ask them a question about the story. I did this the other day with one of my kids. And she responded with what was happening in her story. And so I wrote like a paragraph and an introduction. And then I shared it with her Google account for school and said, that's on your computer now. Go back and do your homework. And it allowed us to participate in such a way that was really very much like my life at work. And really cool to kick it off.
And that is a wonderful story with regard to technology allowing parents to become more present.
Yeah.
which feels rare. Which is so contrary to most of the stories we talk about that.
And I got to say, it's really neat to see their documents and what they do as they go through school.
Okay, so what are the drawbacks?
Well, I don't have a lot of drawbacks except for one idea. And that is that we're not consciously making the decision to have a corporation collect data on our children. But it's kind of mandated at the school, and it's a public school, and that's happening. And I'm not saying that it's a bad thing, I'm not saying it's scary, but I think we should have a better conscious understanding of what this means to engage at a young age in a system that knows you really well. And that's the part of this is it has to do with the whole AI side of it. Maybe we'll get to that in a second. But it's not that I'm saying we shouldn't do this or it's scary or anything like that. Quite the opposite. I think it's great. And I don't feel like our general population has an ability or has the desire to talk about it and what it actually means. And that's concerning.
I do believe that it's scary. I still think we should do it. That's
damn the consequences. My kid's not in elementary school yet.
I don't mean it that way. It's that everything in life has trade-offs. Every time you think like, I'm going to do the absolute best thing for my kid, then you have kids. And it's like, oh, the world has a little bit more nuance than that. Okay, I need to figure out the pros and cons and make an educated choice. And so that's where it comes into play, is saying, okay, we have this company being in charge of the data. And in general, people are more comfortable with a corporation having charge of the data than, for example, the government. I'm just going to speak of the typical American at this point.
Yeah, I don't feel that way necessarily, but go on.
Right. But I'm saying that the general rule of thumb in America, you will hear the, I don't trust the government to do X, Y, and Z. But there are good reasons for that. I mean, we have historical analogs of, you know, Stalinist Russia or the Stasi in East Germany. Of if you have the ability for the government to see everyone's every move at all times, that can be very bad. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's where some of the comfort comes from going to a corporation rather than the government, is that the corporation is usually a voluntary agreement that can be broken.
I mean, like I chose to go to Facebook, for example.
Well, or at least the school district decided they were going to go with them, and they could choose to go with another company if something went bad.
Okay, let me stop for just a second. I know you're on a tangent, and I know you're on a line of thought, but I want to talk about a couple things. First off, the school district is the government. Right?
Yes, it is.
And the idea that we don't trust the government, when you really think about if you're involved in elementary school as a parent, you probably trust the teachers there and you probably trust the administration unless you've had a bad experience. And those are the people that traditionally had all the documentation on your children, right? And it was in a paper file, and some reports once a year had to go to Sacramento or whatever your state capital was to collect standardized tests, things of that nature. But in general, the everyday paper document of what your kid's thinking about, whether they're really interested in ponies or really interested in bubblegum, was not going anywhere except for a few people that you knew.
To underscore that, I think all those tests that went up to the state government were all anonymized, or at least didn't have names on it.
Yeah, even at some level it was anonymized because there's no need for it.
Because we as Americans have a distrust of large huge monolithic organizations.
Collection systems, yeah. And that's, I think, what the government means. Like when I say, do you trust your local school board? Most people say yes. When I say, do you trust your government? They say no. And it has to do with the monolithic quality. And the corporations like Google talk about monolith. I mean, giant.
Right. And thank you, because that leads into my point very well, which was if you are talking about this corporation, which has a more limited scope than the government, than even the...
They don't tax you. They don't control your property. They don't fix the roads. Like they don't invade every part of your life.
Right.
Yet.
This comes into the conversations we've had on this show many times, which is what happens when the government wants access to these companies' data troves.
That's right.
And then it becomes a lot more problematic to say, yes, they can gather all this information over a long period of time, and later on down the road, oh, but now we need this data. The government says we need this data, and then suddenly this treasure trove is available at a level
at a very
of detail.
Different level. Yeah,
at a level
for
of detail,
different reasons.
Yes,
than making money off our children. But in case we're going to talk more about this in just a moment, listening to Geek Speak, we have a story about the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and what they're doing about this scope of the public life being data mined in some way by corporations. We'll be right back here on KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak on Independent Public Radio KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Brian Young and Miles Elam. We're talking about, well, what triggered this discussion about data mining in the public space has to do with a story on December 1st from the EFF, and that's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they're kind of the... What is the best way to describe them?
The ACLU Online.
Thank you. I knew you were going to have that for me. Thank you. The EFF filed against Google with the Federal Trade Commission for collecting and data mining school children's personal information, including their internet searches, a practice EFF uncovered, they say, while researching its spying on students. That's a quote, a campaign which launched on December 1st. The campaign was created to raise awareness about the privacy risks of school-supplied electronic devices and software. And the EFF examined Google's Chromebook and Google Apps for Education. That's an acronym is GAFE, G-A-F-E, a suite of educational cloud-based software programs used by many schools across the country by students as young as 7 years old, like my kids, actually are a little older. So that's what they were talking about there is the Google Docs, the Gmail, Google Docs, Google Drive includes Google Docs, Excel spreadsheets and things of that nature, not Excel, but spreadsheets. And the concern here has to do with the data of the children's activity on their Chromebook goes to Google, and who knows what happens after that.
So their evidence for the mining of the children's data is the fact that they're using these services, because all these services are entirely cloud-based. They're all going to Google anyways, right?
Yeah. So that's the thing about the Chromebooks and why they're so great for educational spaces. It used to, if you imagine, you have a whole bunch of students at different levels of education, knowledge around technology, parents of different levels of technology, and you want to give them these powerful tools that allow you to do all this sharing and amazing work we can do with computers. If you do that, and then you just send the students and say, bring a computer, the nightmare that would happen would be insane, because all the teachers and the IT staff would have to be brought up to speed to fix the kid's hard drive when the hard drive crashed, or you know the battery ran out for this one. Like, having the system in place to do this cleanly would be really expensive and difficult and challenging to do. Except now with something like Google Chromebooks, it becomes a lot easier because of the software that Google has.
Or Google services. The Chromebooks just are the fact that you're doing everything off a web page. Any laptop could do this, but the virtue of
and
the
even
Chromebooks
an iPad
are that,
or tablet,
they're, that they're really cheap. And so if anything happens to them, like what might happen to an elementary age.
7-year-old kid laptop, yeah.
Right. That you can replace it and keep going. Just like if they had a textbook and then they lost their textbook or got damaged or
they could pick up another
one. Whatever. Yeah, you get another one.
So the services we're talking about, what actually happens is you have a Google account and you log in with that Google account. A student would log in with a Google account and they would get all the information about their account. All their papers and their spreadsheets and their slides and all the stuff they have is on there. They'd log out of that laptop and log into another one and they'd have the documents there too. And the only way for that to actually work is to have some centralized location that stores it. And that central location is Google. And of course, what Google does inside behind its closed doors is a little secretive because, of course, they're a corporation and they have privacy.
So
as a corporation.
Does the EFF think that they're actually data mining that information? Do they think they're using it in some way that's...
I think that the best thing to say about the EFF is that they want to pay attention to this space. I don't know if they think anything specifically. But I don't think that's important, because I think that the questions they're asked are pretty interesting. How much should we pay attention to this? Like, is it okay that we've kind of indoctrinated our children at a low level age to put all this stuff and all the trust into some corporation?
Yeah, there is a lot to be said about trust, but verify.
That's right. And how do you verify in a corporation? Like, Miles, you used to work at Google. You can't verify right now what they're doing, right?
I cannot now, no.
But at the time...
And that's a feature, not a bug.
Why?
Because I am not an employee. Now, if they get a subpoena to get access to that information, they have some people that have been vetted, that have the skill set and the trust level to go in and audit, mm-hmm. that's a different thing. That's a different conversation.
And that's, I think, would be a great thing if someone like the EFF could go and audit the systems.
And that's what they're suing about right now.
Is that that's what they're trying to do.
They want some assurance that it's not just on someone, on a corporation's word, but that they see what procedures are in place.
Yeah. So I want to go back to what you said there a minute ago about instilling a pattern of this kind of sharing with the corporation so easily, sort of like the Facebook effect, the younger generations sharing wildly online of things that people never would have shared personally before.
Yeah, it's happening. Definitely, yeah.
So there's this social idea of just willy-nilly trusting the services you use
right.
to keep your information safe.
And so what's great about this is I'm having this conversation with my daughter who had a birthday at some point in the last year. And when she had her birthday, the day of her birthday, she made a little videotape of herself saying, it's my birthday today. And I'm, you know, 10 or 11 or 12, however old she is.
Speaking of being present for your kids.
I'm very present. I'm just not welcoming everyone to be aware that much of my children. And so she puts this on her Instagram feed. And her Instagram feed is private, if you will. It's not public. You have to be invited in. She has to allow you to see her stuff, theoretically. But I know that Facebook has it. And I also know that it would be very easy at one point in her life for her to decide, I should switch my Instagram account to be public. She probably will at some point in her life, right? Because she'll have it and blah, blah. And then her birthday will be there. Now, most likely by that time, her birthday is already out in the world. But I had to explain to her, you know, you just shared your birthday with a corporation and it's on the internet now. And it's kind of public, not really, but it's private. Trying to teach her to be aware of that, because that's what I want. I don't really care if she does it or not. I want her to be aware of what she's doing, right? At the same time, I'm not describing to her that all the documents she writes are also kind of out there somewhere. Like,
we have this idea that once you put something on the internet, and it doesn't matter what walls it's behind, but once you put it on the internet, it's out there. It's public.
Once you pee in the pool, you're not getting it back out again.
But the thing is, we're not even talking about putting it on the internet for her. She's going to school, and she's doing her schoolwork, and her schoolwork is on the internet. And it's not her choice. It's what the school tells her to do. So it's like she's not even going to have the boundary to understand that she's making a decision to put stuff public. Just like if you go to the DMV right now and you do that, you know that the DMV is it's just a matter of time before there's a giant breach of the DMV and all the license cards are, you know, I mean, data breaching is so prevalent now that there's no way you can participate in society without probably having your data shared. Like that's just how it's going to happen now. I mean, is that too pessimistic?
Well, no. Unfortunately, the truth of it's there. But
the sad part is that Google is going to be the safest place for your data in a lot of
senses. You're totally right. That's the other thing that's so great is that, yeah, I know that Google's practices of privacy are probably better than any other organization on the planet.
Well, not just the practices of privacy, just their ability to withstand attack.
Right. I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Security. I didn't mean privacy. I'm sorry. It's very easy to say that. So Google, when they and a whole bunch of other corporations kind of entered the student privacy area, they wrote a pledge, and you can actually read this at studentprivacypledge.org, and they pledged, amongst a lot of things, it's a really simple document, but it's only a page, but I'll show you a few things, not to sell student information, not behaviorally targeted, no behaviorally targeted advertising, use data for authorized education purposes only, not to change privacy policies without notice and choice, enforce strict limits on data retention, support parental access to and correction of errors in the children's information, provide comprehensive security standards, be transparent about collection and use of data. So they've pledged, Google and like 150 other companies have pledged to do that. So they're definitely in that space of understanding that there's an importance here to pay attention to.
Well, yeah. And if all that holds true, then I say, oh, this is great. But you started this by the concern of what our children are aware of that they're doing.
Yeah. I think the awareness of our society about these problems is not being addressed. And in fact, early before they even understand these comprehensions of what politic and what being a citizen is, it happens before they get that level. They are already doing it. They're already participating in this game of giving your personal information, who you are, to some other entity that you don't control or manage or even have a vote and a say-so, right? I mean, that's the thing, Miles, about government versus corporation is the truth is what we can have the government do as a citizen is different than what we can have a corporation do. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, we have representatives in the government side and we don't in the corporation side.
Yes, except for the money we spend. And then comes, then you get into the whole like antitrust things and yeah. whether there's competition. And then there's also people with more money have more say. But then again, that's true of our government.
Big time.
It's a whole rabbit hole there.
Well, let's flip this around though. Yeah. So here's Google, this huge corporation with all these data scientists and all these other engineers. What if they could actually do something really good with that data? What if they could actually look at that data and find usefulness that nobody ever thought of?
Yeah. In fact, that is is very likely to happen, right? I mean, because the truth is, as we've never been able to do what Google can do at this time, right? What Google can do theoretically is something that humans haven't been able to do before, right?
Because we haven't had the data all sitting there in one place.
Right. If you've heard of big data, this is a new paradigm in how we can understand the world. And it's happening now. And at the same time, our children are, you know, growing up with it. So yeah, neat, amazing things are going to come of this. Absolutely. I'm very optimistic around technology.
We could mention the whole, like, what is the level of ability for students checking in the aggregate, in the large, and collating by school, collating by teacher, collating, I mean, there are all these, having this data available is awesome.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it's with great responsibility. You know, yeah. With great power comes great responsibility and all that.
That is a wonderful question, Brian. Like, what will they be able to do?
I mean, they could right now, you know how we have stats across the country about how well our kids are learning in different subjects. They could go into that treasure trove and actually see analytically what our grammar is and whether it's improving and our yeah. spelling and many other metrics that are easy to do.
And I would say that they'd probably, given this was the use of the service was broad spread across many, many school districts, they very easily could have a better understanding of what kids are learning and not learning and how well they're learning by teacher, by school, better probably than standardized tests.
Surely.
Right, because there's a lot more data there.
And all those kids that don't test well would all of a sudden get data on them.
Potentially shine, right? Yeah. Wow, this kid has hundreds of papers of content that's grammatically great. And right. Of course, they test poorly. Well, that's interesting. I mean, there's a lot to find there. And Google, of course, is saying that in their pledge, they're not actually going to do that kind of thing.
Right.
Which is actually kind of a shame in some ways, right? I remember a wonderful discussion about privacy in medical areas, because we're all very concerned about privacy in medicine.
Sure.
And because, you know, your body's private and there's a lot of concern about it.
And there's insurance ramifications and yeah. things like that.
And there's very strict laws around how you collect data around people's health. But if you could have large corporations looking at aggregate data about health, we would know a lot better, more about health. Like, that's the next step we need. Like, we need a lot of information about how to solve, you know, solve the problems of disease.
Right, which is why so many people are excited about cell phones and watches and things that can actually monitor our health.
This stuff,
potentially.
Yeah. But of course, the rules are in place to protect that because of the privacy concerns. So that's an interesting boundary. Miles, you're reading something. Are we time to move on? I'm good with moving on.
Okay.
I was thinking about talking about artificial intelligence, Brian. You ready?
Well, yeah, yeah. So
kind of leads into it.
Yeah, it does, because how are they going to analyze all that data other than through AI? And artificial intelligence has been around a long time, and we've actually had quite a few leaders in the tech community that have been pretty outspoken about a number of things. You can think about going back to Asimov's three rules of robotics. Am I saying that right?
Three laws.
Three laws of robotics, yeah. So that may be one of the...
and how they were wholly inadequate in every single novel.
That was the whole point of those three rules, right?
Well, yeah.
Robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey orders given by human beings, except where such orders conflict with the first law. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection law does not conflict with the first or second law. Right? Seems simple enough.
Right. So Asimov's thinking here, how can we protect from things going wrong once mm-hmm. you start making computers have the ability to think? And this is something that our tech leaders have been thinking about for a long time, including people like Bill Gates and Elon Musk and others. And so they've decided to do something about it. Right now, all of the incentives for or all of the research in AI is pretty much being driven by large corporations and in some cases universities. But even then, I'm sure money going to some of the universities finds its way from these large corporations. So the incentive there is to build something that doesn't necessarily have society in mind. So they wanted to build a nonprofit foundation company that is going to be able to lead their own research and do this with society's needs and desire and protections in mind.
When you talk about AI, artificial intelligence, are you talking about sentient computers, self-aware, self-driven machines?
Yeah, so that's been the dream, right?
Yeah.
And we're not there yet. And it's kind of like the flying car. We've heard about that for decades.
There's this kind of joke in software complexity that all you have to do to solve any software problem is create a self-learning machine, and then they'll solve it for you. That's all you gotta do. Of course, it's been quite elusive. And there's a lot of reasons why it's elusive, but probably because the software engineering, software sciences, computer sciences are actually at its infancy of understanding. Like, we don't really know the level we will know at some point about software creation. But in any case, what about all this stuff that's already happening? Like, we just talked all about what Google could do if it could get all this other data, or what Facebook does on and like Facebook can control people's reactions to events by what they show them. And these are also artificial intelligence, right? These algorithms are artificial intelligence.
They are. Well,
they're machine learning, less than artificial intelligence, though.
Wouldn't machine learning is a part of artificial intelligence. Like, it's part of the scope.
I think it's baby steps. I think it's the early steps, right? You've got to have those things in place to build upon, right?
Sure.
You don't think of the same thing, Miles? Why?
I don't. I do think of machine learning very much as a, here is a problem set and we're going to point you in the right direction and then go through to...
Oh, so because you understand how to implement machine learning, therefore it's not scary to you, or it's not artificial intelligence.
No, machine learning requires a non-trivial amount of input from the original programmer.
Yeah.
AI, I think of as that point where you stop having to give as much input and it starts generating.
Okay,
its own.
But that's what machine learning is in some way. You set up a system.
Machine learning
which
is
then,
used for it. I guess I think of it as machine learning is used to get to AI, but I don't think.
Well,
that
let's
they are
talk.
The same
let's
thing.
Talk about. I agree to some degree that there's a boundary there that is unclear. I mean, like I agree that not exactly the same thing, but I also think of the complexity in place around Google search results or Facebook's feed system, where what it shows you and what it doesn't show you and how it interacts. And these things, and Netflix, I work at Netflix, right? So Netflix's ability to present data to you about what movies you'd like. These systems are really complicated software packages. Mm-hmm. And they're so complicated that they're algorithms on top of algorithms and software on top of the software built over years, such that the same engineer probably wasn't there the whole time. But even if she was there the entire time, she worked on some pieces at a time. And therefore, no one person really knows how Facebook's feed algorithm system works, how Netflix movie recommendation system works, how Google's search recommendation works. And yet those systems are designed and honed and relearn themselves, if you will, to do their task the best they possibly can. Netflix to get you to watch TV, Google to use and read web pages, Facebook and click on ads, maybe whatever, and Facebook to have you engage on the service as much as possible. Like that's the goals of these algorithms that no person really understands. That to me sounds like an artificial intelligence.
That's where I just disagree. I disagree.
All right.
So what?
Maybe you're smarter than me.
So Google's whole system to identify the objects in photographs, that's not some kind of AI?
It's, I guess what I think of in terms of AI is a self-knowledge.
Can you define that in just a minute when we get back? You're listening to Geek Speak on KOSP. Miles Elam, Brian Young, and I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll be right back. You're listening to Independent Public Radio, KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell with Brian Young. And Miles Elam, you were talking about AI.
So I want to hearken back to our childhoods. Did you ever play Sierra games like King's Quest?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And
these were text-based games mostly that you typed on your
basic
computer.
Basic graphics, CGA, yeah, EGA graphics.
Go north, go west, whatever.
Yeah. And usually they were type of verb, type of noun.
Yeah, right.
And so they ended up being very complex for their time, but still limited by the paths that you could take.
Right. You'd go someplace, you'd find a jar, and then that'd be in your inventory, and later you'd find some slime. And you had no – it didn't tell you what to do, but you could say – slime, put slime jar, something like that.
Yeah.
And then it would, you'd
put
always
slime in jar, yeah.
Slime collected, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over time, the games got more and more complex, and the decision trees became more and more complex. Mm-hmm. But they were still the same concept. And I have a problem calling that King's Quest game AI. And just because you have a greater tree, it's still talking about this ultimate goal that is already predetermined.
Well, when does that complexity get greater than, like?
And there comes the question of, am I just putting the human mind on too much of a pedestal, which is a possibility.
The definition of artificial intelligence? Like self-aware artificial intelligence. We have a very clear rule, right?
Do we?
Yeah. About
We have the Turing test.
Yeah. So can you describe what the Turing test is, Miles?
The Turing test is if you have a human interviewer and they cannot see who they're interviewing. They could be interviewing another human or they could be interviewing a machine, some non-human entity. And if that interviewer cannot tell that the non-human entity distinguish between the two, then that computer passes the Turing test. Now,
wait. What basically infers that you have to assume that the machine is just as intelligent or self-aware as the human. Because how else do you know about self-awareness but except for from external features? So if you can't distinguish it, it is a self-aware entity.
That's the idea. Because of that notion of privacy in your thoughts, that your own personal thoughts are private. I can't know what you're thinking. I can't know what you're actually feeling despite what you may say.
Right.
Because you are duplicitous.
There's actually a whole test, these whole games around this. You can actually do this as a software development hobby. It's really kind of fun.
Right. But that comes the question of, and like I said, I may be guilty of this, of treating the human brain as a decision tree, which I don't believe that it is, that it fits that that definition.
Why not? You think there's some magic?
No, I don't believe there's some magic.
Well, then what is it besides a decision tree? I mean, it's a neural net, right? Okay, let's not get into the philosophical of that because we'll go really deep. But your idea is that, okay, as complicated as a storytelling engine with a lot of branches could get, it's not really ever going to have artificial intelligence to your position because it doesn't have flexibility. It doesn't do that this one thing.
The start point and the end point are not open-ended.
Are kind of deterministic. You could put some randomness in it, though. It wouldn't be, right? There's story generation software that can do some amazing things. And I bet you could...
Yes, right? But their goal is to make a good story.
Right.
As opposed to, does the machine want to make a good story?
But here's the next point I want to talk about. When we talk about the Turing test normally, we're talking about whether this thing is smart or as human or as self-aware as a human, right? But in reality, we have other self-aware things on the planet, right? Mm-hmm. Higher mammals, there's self-awareness. My dog knows it exists.
Birds. Right? Yeah.
Birds. I mean, there's a lot of that going on. So those brains are relatively alien to us, and the communication is pretty minimal. Mm-hmm. So we don't give a lot of amaze to it. If we had a computer course algorithm that was as good as like a dog at its intelligence, we'd be amazed by it, right? I mean, there's some power there.
But they are autonomous.
Yes, they are autonomous. From a physical perspective, you're not autonomous. I mean, you're connected to your society. Like, you have to eat. I mean, you have to have love or you die. I mean, you're not autonomous either. But my point...
Not completely independent, but I am autonomous.
Okay, yes. So, but autonomy is not necessarily denote intelligence, right? Yeah. But more than that, the software patterns, let's talk about like a rule set like make people read Facebook. That's what Facebook's algorithms do. Make people read Facebook, right? So the better the algorithms are at understanding people's motivations, the better they are at implementing that, the better they'll do at controlling people. Like that's what it's about, right?
Mm-hmm.
That to me is a trait of a human being, of being able to manipulate people, right? It actually kind of, when I say manipulate, it sounds kind of evil. But there's definitely,
They're exploiting logical fallacies, which is what marketing is.
Not necessarily even logical fallacies, no. I mean, if you like cats, and I keep on getting attracted to cats, it's not a fallacy necessarily. It's not a logical thing. It's my personal emotions and the logic of the inherent.
Okay.
So my point, though, is that the ideal of having a self-aware intelligence does not denote all intelligence. All intelligences don't have to necessarily be self-aware. You can still have an intelligence that is so alien to us that even the concept of personhood isn't the same, right? You read some great science fiction and you have species that have one cohesive mind. That would still be intelligence, but they wouldn't say they were self-aware because it's the entire species. So, like, the alien quality of intelligence is so crazy that it's hard to say that that isn't, you know, self-awareness is the thing, or the ability to act by your own intent is the thing. I think anything that shows a complexity that can be marveled at and that can manipulate people and the world, that's an intelligence. That's something that's powerful.
Well, its ability to manipulate human beings is also not a good benchmark.
I agree.
Okay.
Because puppies do that too.
But
I wouldn't say that's a good mark, good benchmark. I'm just saying that it still is in the scope of artificial intelligence.
What it sounds like you're saying is you're defining intelligence isn't necessarily human intelligence.
Yeah, I think that's the thing I think is the most complex problem to understand. Like, even understanding a second language is problematic. Understanding another intelligence is not, I don't think it's something we're able to do. Like, we're really good at quantum physics compared to understanding intelligences, in my mind.
well, yeah, and we judge intelligence by what we see other humans exhibit, what our own thought exhibits. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that's the only form of intelligence. If you could have these systems that are enormously complex, contributing or showing intelligence that maybe we wouldn't have, but would make decisions that we find to be intelligent, that's a form of intelligence. It just isn't going to be a human. It's not going to necessarily pass the Turing test, even, because mm-hmm. a Turing test is about whether you're human intelligent enough to pass yourself off as a human.
So does that make a computer artificial intelligence parasitic on the human intelligence?
I would say Facebook, Google, and Netflix are all parasitic on the human intelligence. I don't know. Parasitic? Do you get joy out of it? Get joy out of your Facebook feed?
That has nothing to do with...
Well, why not? I mean, you don't have to call it a parasite.
You mean call it symbiotic.
You could call it symbiotic instead.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say my 14-year-old probably thinks the computer is a symbiotic with him rather than lecherous with him. But I don't know if he can go without the phone in his hand for 10 minutes. So who knows? If it's parasitic.
I guess I think of it in terms of with a phone, like a phone, modern-day smartphones, especially if they're network-connected.
Mm-hmm.
Make us cybernetic beings. They make us enhanced humans in some ways.
Just like every other tool we've ever made.
Right. Now,
can we say augment instead of enhanced?
Sure. Okay. Augmented. And at the same time, take away the phone, there is still the human. Take away the human, what is the phone?
Just junk in a landfill.
And yet that phone has facilities.
Take away the human.
Such as Siri and stuff like that. So take away the human, what is it? I guess that's my portion of, that's what I meant by autonomy. Like,
So that's, that to get the intelligence you're talking about, they have to have autonomous input where they can explore.
Even if they have a dependence upon us to do certain functions, there has to be some self-affecting aspect.
Good. So not necessarily self-aware, but self-motivated or something else that's independent from us. But that assumes, so that would be a non, what do you call it a second ago when two creatures work together?
Symbiotic.
You want to see an artificial intelligence that is non-symbiotic with humans, right? Not like the Google search ranking system, which is like completely based on humans being the other side of that.
Well, symbiosis doesn't necessarily mean that the other requires the other to live. Symbiosis just means that there's a mutual benefit.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you're listening to Geek Speak, and we've got some more time. I think we're done with the artificial intelligence story. That was fun. That was really fun, actually. Should we go on to something else? Miles, you got something, right?
I do. So the FAA is saying it's time to register those drones.
They've actually come out and said it. Time to register drones.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
They're trying to make it an online registration process. They're trying to make it cheap.
What's the point of registering them?
Well, first of all, let's review what some of the things that have happened, like all the firefighters that have been prevented from doing their job because drones are flying around taking videos of a fire.
Right. If something enters the airspace of a active forest fire, then the fire crews cannot fly into the area to dump water or fire retardant on it.
Yeah. The idea of registering is old school idea. Like, I think that's the wrong way to do it.
Registration, in other words, determining ownership and determining that the person has agreed to a set of rules of conduct.
So you mean
registration means in this case.
Yeah. So you mean that all these drones would be identifiable to who the owner is?
That's the idea, yeah.
Right, so if you have a flag, you'd have a flag or something with a serial number on it or something like that.
So it creates accountability, right?
Yeah, yeah. I like the idea of accountability.
And it's a $5 fee, but it'll be waived for those who register by mid-January. So it can be free if they do it now.
And if you don't register, you got to keep it off public land?
Then it would be, This is an open
in how it's
thing because it's never been litigated.
Sure. I like the idea. If you're going to fly it in a town, it makes sense that you've registered it. And in doing registration, you understand some of your responsibilities. It totally makes sense.
So, yeah, do they even talk about any licensing that might be involved? We've got other shared resources of our community.
They're not going as far
society.
As licensing. It really does come down to who does this drone belong to and do they acknowledge that they need to follow a certain set of rules?
That's
like,
cool.
Don't fly it in restricted airspace.
I
don't
totally
fly,
support this.
You know, below a certain altitude over someone's house. You know, like
I think it's a good idea. I mean, I think that, we've obviously seen a lot of odd uses of drones. Flamethrowers being put on them, guns being put on them, marijuana being dropped into prisons with them. I mean, you know, a lot of stuff's happened.
and causing riots. Yeah.
Right. I don't think any of those things will stop happening if you have to register for a $5 fee, but I do think that it makes sense in some ways to increase the level of awareness, because once you produce a group of people that understand like the rules and that there's a registration process, when you buy one, you kind of just, I got to register it? Okay. That you start producing a society effect, if you will, of owners of those devices.
If you are licensed to drive, it is assumed that you have seen the driver's test and you have gone through that.
Well, licensing, you actually get tested, right?
Right. That's where I was going with that. Yeah,
it seems like the next
step
would be
that. You've been given access to this information. Where you don't have the license, when you have the registration for the car, that like you've registered this vehicle, that you've acknowledged that like, yes, I have this vehicle. I am going to take liability with regard to its usage,
sure,
stuff like that. That's the part that is missing from drones right now.
And I would say that you'd want to do that at a certain size class. You'd want to say, look, anything above this power level or above this battery duration, like there could be a level there that would make sense, because there are some drones that you can fit in the palm of your hand that can fly 20 feet before the power runs out.
And the wind blows them away.
And I am totally fine with a 12-year-old being at the park with that without registering.
But that's,
you know, like,
but
there
that's
needs to be a level.
A range thing. Yeah. So if you found something that could fit in the palm of your hand that could still go up to 10,000 feet.
Well, that's the thing, is that something that size isn't even going to be seen by a helicopter, and it wouldn't affect a helicopter, right? Like, it's not going to do anything it's not going to interfere with anybody. It's too small. It's the size of a bird. You know?
A bullet's pretty small.
I said a bird.
going at full speed,
it could be speed, but I'm just saying that if you
and then what happens if you have a swarm of them? What happens if you have
7,000 of them? We can do anything.
If it has the capability to get into the way of other things, it needs to have some accountability.
Brian, you're a digital artist and programmer. You've been in the digital art space. You've probably bought a copy of Adobe at some point, some Adobe product.
Oh yeah, well, actually, have I? You know, I have never purchased a copy of Adobe software.
Because you always worked at corporations that gave it to
schools,
you.
Schools and companies. Mm-hmm. And
I have, for 8 KOSP.
What do you buy?
I bought Adobe Acrobat KOSP a while back.
I one time was given the entire Photoshop suite at a show, which was awesome. Because other than that, I think I've bought Lightroom. Lightroom is a great tool. But Adobe...
Back when you could actually own it as opposed to rent.
That's right. Adobe Software, maker of Acrobat, of course, and also Photoshop, Illustrator, Adobe Audition, which is a sound editing software I use to edit GeekSpeak, actually. Lightroom, a photo management software package, which is really quite fantastic. My entire library of 100,000 photos is in Lightroom. Premiere, which is video editing Flash Professional, which you might have heard of, Dreamweaver, After Effects, InDesign, and a myriad of other really quite impressive software has migrated over the last few years to a software subscription service. Adobe traditionally created software with version numbers, Photoshop 5, for example, and would sell that version with the list of features, you know, whatever was in Photoshop 5. Someone, or hopefully some business or a school, would purchase a license for Photoshop version 5, and then you'd be pinned to that version of Photoshop. That's what you'd have on your computer. And the company would do some patches and bug fixes for version 5, you know, a few different fixes, but generally would devote most of their considerable software development prowess to making the next version of Photoshop, version 6, which will have all the amazing new features. This type of software version selling leads to some problems which affect the creators and the consumers, or the users. One, for example, your machine changes over time, new hardware, new operating system, and as your machine changes, to make Photoshop 5 keep working, small changes need to take place, small software fixes. Adobe will need to recompile for a new OS or perhaps fix a bug due to the changes in your operating system. But the software developers are mostly tasked to making the next version, which is where their revenue is going to come from next quarter. So older versions simply do not get kept up to date, which means over time, it's harder and harder to run those older versions. And so the person that's purchasing software has to continually buy the newest version. Now, you can wait for a long period of time until it degrades to the point where you can't use it, but at some point you're going to have to buy that package again. And that's because the older version is going to degrade over time. Which is funny if you think about it, because of course, physical world degrades over time. You would think that software potentially wouldn't have to degrade, but it does because the operating systems and the machines change. Okay, two. The software developers, project managers, and marketing need to also make the new version compelling enough for you to plop down another large amount to buy the next version, which I think means that software is worked on mostly to make it compelling enough to sell again, not necessarily to make it better to use. And there is a difference. If there's something that's irking you a little bit or something you really wanted it to do, that feature would probably be worked on.
Yeah.
But in general, the general use of the application, which you're, you know, working through, you're making it work for yourself, you're learning it, might not be worked on as much because it's hard to sell, easier to use. Okay, one partial solution to this whole problem was to allow for cheaper upgrades. That means if you had a copy of Photoshop 5, Photoshop 6 would only cost half as much as if you didn't have Photoshop 5. And this was a lot better for some people and for companies that kept on buying the most recent version, but it did not help the barrier to entry, if you will, for new users. If you've never bought Photoshop, you're going to have to buy the most expensive version. And we're talking like $500, $600 for a suite, I think. It varied. So Adobe switched to a licensed pattern, which means that every month you would pay some money. Now, you wouldn't own anything. You just get access to it. And it's kind of wonky in the sense that you don't own anything. You only have access to it. But if you've ever read an EULA, a user license agreement, which comes with every software package, you'll realize that actually you only own a license to that software. You don't actually own the software. And that's a legalese thing, but yeah, it might make you sleep at night. In any case, the benefit of this was that there was only one application that they work on. Well, they work on multiple applications, but for Photoshop, for example, they only work on one version of Photoshop, and they always improve it in small increments, releasing patches. The more they make it better, the more likely people are to stay with the service of access to Photoshop. It's a pretty compelling model. Now, I'm biased, of course, because I work for a service company, and that's what we do. We try to improve the service all the time so people stay with us. But for this kind of software, I've got to say, there's some real benefits. If you look at the average amount of money of a real Photoshop user, for example, of buying it, I don't know, $500 or $600 every couple years, that's about what the services costs per month, if you break it out, right? Except you don't have to do it in a lump sum, and you don't have to keep on upgrading. In the sense, you don't have to buy the software and then install it. You're just always getting upgraded. This is the pattern for browsers now. Mozilla and Chrome don't have version releases. They just always upgrade. And this is essential for software nowadays because you always kind of need to be on top of it. Vulnerabilities are a big reason. Vectors, if you will, virus vectors. And this is because software complexity is such that working on it means always fixing it. And that's just kind of the way it is. So Adobe has moved this, and their revenue shows that it's been extremely successful. Adobe's last quarter earnings is a record $1.3 billion in revenue, and 74% of that comes from the subscription services.
And when they did this, I was really nervous about this. I did not like this idea at all. I'm the kind of person that I want to buy and what I have, and I don't want to just disappear when I stop paying for something. I hate the idea of software services and my software going away. At the same time, I got to admit, the prices they charge for this were so low that it's given a lot of people the chance to use the software that never would have had a chance before.
And also, the thing about being a software developer is I know that when you buy software, all you've got is a terminal thing that will be bad at one point.
Yep, yeah. Just one operating system away from being useless.
I actually had someone say, do you do any document writing, technical writing? I'm like, yeah, I do. Well, send me some of your stuff. And I finally found the CD that had my writing on it. Yeah, it was in FrameMaker.
Could you open it?
No, I don't have that software. I don't have anything that can load the software. It's...
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like it. You can even make money off it. Just let them know the geek said hi. This is Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit geekspeak.org or email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, or visit us on Twitter or Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell with Miles Elam and Brian Young. Guys, thank you so much for joining me today.
Sure. Always a pleasure.
And also thanks to Chandler and our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley. Hey, we'll see you next week, and do visit us online.
As a side note, completely apropos of nothing, do either of you ever wonder if you would be smarter or more capable or, you know, better emotionally had we not grown up at the tail end of leaded gasoline?